narrow bandwidth depends upon the guy who is using the antenna and what he's using it for.
Absolutely. You know, I do a lot of work with MagLoop, and they're narrow-banded antennas. And my contribution to the state-of-the-art is I don't try to make the frequency agile. I built monoband antennas, which eliminates the servo and eliminates the vacuum variable because I built the capacitor out of the same copper pipe that I built the antenna out of. So that's my contribution to the state of the art. But if the antenna is really efficient, it's very, very narrow. And my antenna is narrow, but not very, very narrow. So I guess I'm not as efficient as I could be. But once again, that's a good thing. On 20 meters, I cover from 1408 to the bottom of the band. That's all I'm interested in. Over.
Okay, I'm curious. Have you ever seen the, I think it's a Ciro Mazza. It's an Italian magnetic loop.
I worked the guy in Singapore who was running one. It's the most expensive mag loop that's available. The capacitor design is interesting. They mechanically warp the antenna, and there are plates on each section at the top. And so when you warp the antenna, you're moving the plates in and out, and that's the way it accomplishes tuning. It's interesting because they can get some spacing. But I worked John at 931VZ on 30 and on 40, and he was using a mag loop and in a very high noise area. And I heard him better than he heard me over.
Oh, that's good to hear. It's interesting for a whole bunch of different reasons. Most people, just by the fact that most magnetic loops that they see are inductively driven, the Ciro Mazza is a gamma match driven magnetic loop.
All of my loops have been gamma match driven. It's more efficient than the Faraday loop. I would like to learn about using a toroid and a couple of times like transformer coupling, but that's not very popular, but I don't know if it's any good or not. It's certainly convenient. The gamma match is quite easy. If you look at my QRZ.com page, you can see my 20-meter loop, and if you look closely, you can see the gamma match over.
Yeah, I mean, it's relatively somewhat common, but for the average guy who doesn't really know anything about magnetic loops, they tend to think of the inductive driven. Also, the bidirectionality of magnetic loops isn't really that perfect. It tends to be somewhat more asymmetrical with gamma matches. Have you found that to be the case?
Wouldn't know. I haven't done that kind of an analysis. I can tell you a couple of things that the manufacturers won't tell you. There's a lot of junk out there. To begin with, when you got a frequency agile antenna, the weak point is the capacitor, because that's a high voltage point, which is why so many mag loops are made for QRP. It'll flash over at the capacitor if you try to run any power. Also, you can make a hula hoop resonant on 160 meters if you add enough tuning capacitance. It'll keep your transmitter very happy. But that doesn't mean you're going to work anybody. That doesn't mean the antenna is going to be efficient. The fact is, if you study the formulas, maximum frequency is coincidental with minimum capacity. And so the loop is only truly efficient at the highest frequency it covers when the lights drop. Some places will tell you when you read it that a small loop is defined as a tenth of a wavelength of circumference, which is absolute baloney. self-resonance occurs at a third of a wavelength circumference, and high efficiency is going to be over a quarter of a wavelength of the radiator. So when you think of designing a monoband loop, just think of meters equal to feet circumference. If you want to build a 20-meter antenna, you need 20-foot circumference. If you want to build a 30-meter antenna, you need a 30-foot circumference. That's the only way you're going to get efficiency. Let me let it drop. The conductor that you make the antenna out of has to be a large diameter. How large? Very large. You know, 4 inches is not too large. But wait a second, what kind of material is that large? You can't get copper pipe that large. First of all, it'd be very expensive. Second of all, it'd be very heavy. The trend now is that people are using copper foil and they're wrapping it around PVC or pool noodles like a barber pole. And that's the latest trend in mag loop. But once again, eliminate the servo drive, eliminate the tuning capacitor, and build it a monoband antenna, and you'll have high efficiency, and you'll be able to run power, because when you build the capacitor, then you can make it wide plate spacing. And the last thing, let me let it drop. Please don't buy a mag loop. Read anything by W5QJR. Read anything by W6NBC. Ask me. Don't buy. Build. Because if you buy and it doesn't work, you won't have a clue. And if you build, you'll make it work, and it works well. It's a good antenna. But you got to build it. Back to now.
Okay, words of wisdom, Alan. Unfortunately, a lot of hams want to have their cake and eat it too. They would like to have something that tunes from 10 to 160 meters, as ridiculous as that sounds. And the reasoning why that's not a good idea, as you mentioned, in another way of describing it, is there's something called ohmic resistance, which is the insertion loss that ends up heating things up and not radiating any RF. And there's radiation resistance, which is the using up energy in the transfer to RF, which is the whole idea of all of our antennas. And the problem is that the radiation resistance for magnetic loops as a group are not fantastic and get progressively worse, as you mentioned, as the tuning requires more and more capacitance. You might get away with a radiation resistance of 1 or 2 ohms at the very highest frequency. As you bring that to a lower and lower frequency, it's not unusual to have a radiation resistance of 0.002 ohms, which is bad, because the insertion loss becomes a much more important factor, which is when you describe the fact that by having a high conducting metal over a large surface area, you are improving the conductivity and increasing the insertion loss, so that it will have less of an effect in relation to the lower radiation resistance value.
Can I restate that in a much easier way to understand?
Feel free.
Okay. Listen carefully now. The efficiency of energy is simply the proportion of the radiation resistance to the ohmic resistance. In a mag loop, the radiation resistance is minuscule. I'm talking hundredths of an ohm. So any ohmic resistance is absolutely intolerable, which is why you have to fill this solder each joint, which is why another reason why bolting in a vacuum variable isn't a good idea, because you can't solder it, you have to bolt it. Yeah. reason. When Ted Hart developed the split stator capacitor, he welded the plate of the stator to eliminate resistance and let the butterfly float, and ended up with half the capacitance because of two sections within a series. But anyway, the efficiency of any antenna is that proportion between the ohmic resistance and radiation resistance. And in the MagLoop, the radiation resistance is really tiny. In a mobile antenna, the radiation resistance is low. The ohmic resistance becomes intolerable. Over.
Okay, Alan, 6 to 1, half a dozen of the other. I agree with you. I just used a little different words. That's the big problem with these guys who have 160-meter ham sticks on their bumpers, on their cars. You know, I mean, the efficiency of something like that is less than 1%, but sometimes less than 1% is all that you need to make the contact that you want to make.
I'm on echo link, but at least in my shack, in my radio,
most of
both the Sheldon and the Middle Island link, I have full carriers on both, but no audio. I don't know what that's about. If somebody is on Sheldon, could you come back? Maybe it's just my radio, but I went on a couple of other computers, and the radio seems fine. So that's why I'm on Echolink. I wanted to ask Alan if he thinks, I'm thinking of getting 2-inch PVC and wrapping it in tin foil. Maybe a couple of wraps of tin foil on each leg of the loop. If he thinks that would be okay. Go ahead.
Well, I think you can do better than 2-inch PVC. You can cool. But tin foil is no good because you can't solder to it. Copper foil. I never saw silver foil, but I guess that would be okay. You need copper foil over it.
I know a guy who's he's using aluminum tape. So I'm just wondering how he solders to the aluminum tape. And it may be W6NBC, as you were saying, but somebody out there who's got a couple of good videos on YouTube is using aluminum tape. Go ahead.
So I'd be very surprised if John Portone was using aluminum tape. I've spoken to him and corresponded with him, and he understands the antenna very completely. And as do I, and as does Ted Hart, probably many others, but aluminum is a bad choice for many reasons. But what John Portone taught me, he wrote a hold on, let me let drop. He wrote a QSB article a while back about a 40-meter loop for pickup truck or something. And what I call a coaxial capacitor. He used two different sizes of copper pipe, with one inside the other, like a hypodermic needle. And I thought that was wrong, because if you look at my floors that page, you can see my capacitor design. It looks like a waffle iron. It's labor-intensive and quite expensive. It's just much simpler and much less expensive, and I thank them for saving a lot of time and money over.
I wonder if I can use, let's say, aluminum foil tape, and then right where it needs to be soldered to the capacitor, wind some copper tape. You think that would work, Alan?
Well, no. The problem is soldering to the capacitor, because if you make it loop out of aluminum foil tape. You can make the capacitor out of aluminum foil tape. And you don't have to solder to it at all because it's all one piece connected over.
What kind of sliding plate, if I'm correct, like sliding plate sets the capacitor, but what kind of voltage can they handle, if something like that handle?
All right, look. Put your microphone down. Hold your two hands in front of your face and make a circle out of your two hands. You're looking at the tops of your hands, and they're all connected in a circle. Now take your pointer fingers and bend them down towards the center of the circle. The distance between them will determine the capacitance and the voltage handling capability of the capacitor. The length of them will determine the voltage handling capability of the capacitor. And there is no joint where they connect to the rest of your hand. They're part of your hand over.
Yes, I understand that, but what kind of voltage could something like that take as compared to a vacuum capacitor?
The amount of voltage that the homebrew capacitor can withstand depends upon the spacing between the plates. I would estimate that for every quarter of an inch you've got 2 kV. That's conservative. Maybe even 3, but I estimate for every quarter of an inch you've got 2 kV. How much voltage do you want? 30 kV?
Do you, on your website, do you have clear pictures of the capacitor that you made?
Oh, I've got a clear picture of the antenna. The capacitor is part of the antenna. Yeah, and you can blow it up. You can make it bigger. Take a look on the website if you have any questions. I'll be glad to answer something. Let's not take up the next time with this folder.
All right, well, the Met has, this is the kind of stuff that the Met should be taking time with. I'm very into Mad Loops myself. It was this guy on the West Coast who came up with a controller board for, motor driving the capacitor, and whether it's air variable or vacuum tube. I know what you mean by having to put a collar around the vacuum tube rather than soldering into it, but I'll definitely take a look. Could you say again what the website is, what the URL of the website is?
Okay. First of all, W5QJR, Ed Hart, holds patent on the design. The ARRL had a design competition for the best antenna that would cover 20 to 10, including the warp band. And the number one design was a large periodic made out of wire called Telerana. I think it was YB5DFJ. And Ted Hart's design, the Mag Loop, was number two, even though the Mag Loop has absolutely no gain, because he used the servo drive and a homebrew. Not a vacuum variable. I don't know what you call it. It's a split stator capacitor. And tuned the antenna and took number two. And I was so impressed, and I had extensive correspondence with him before I even built my first one. And when they let it drop, if you get into it, the problem with these antennas is no sooner you start building one than you figure out how the next one's going to be better. You you're always thinking about how the next one's going to be, because you haven't even finished the one you're working on, and you already know how the next one's going to be better. It's an amazing evolution. It's exciting. I enjoy it. I understand the antenna well. Ted Hart wrote a bunch of formulas, and I'm not a mathematician, but I built so many of the antennas. I built so many of the antennas that now the formula is taught to me. I understand how one parameter affects the other in efficiency and power handling capability. It's really a nice design. I like it a lot. The W5QJR is one good. W6NBC, John Fortune, is the other who completely understands the antenna. And those are the only two that I can recommend. I'm sure that there are others, but there's also a lot of people who just like to hear themselves talk. So.
Yes, what's your website?
I don't have a website. The picture of my antenna is on my qrz.com. I'm MQKW.
Okay. I'll take a look on QRZ. Thanks, Alan. Thanks, Roy. WQBC. Anybody know if there's anything wrong with Selden and Middle Island?
Is NY2H, I'm listening on Middle Island.
For some reason, I'm just getting full deflection of the S meter with no audio. I just don't get it. It has to be something here. Thanks, W2BG, back to me.
Make sure your PLD code is off. You got to change the alpha PL again. You probably want to go without an alpha PL if you can. Otherwise, change it to 127.3.
Oh, I got it. 127.3 for the alpha. Okay. Thanks, Luke.
You got it. Good evening, Roy. That's it.
Yes, good evening, Lou. I just want to get back to Steve, MDC. We kind of moved away from your subject. Any other questions on it?
No, not at all. Gave me a little bit of homework to do. Play with some heights, play with some radios, and conversation on MagLoop was very interesting, and always glad to get an education. Once again, I thank you for your time and your efforts answering my questions.
Well, you're welcome, Steve. Anytime, you know where to find us. This is AC2GS. If anyone else has any comments or questions, or topics for discussion tonight, feel free to hit that push to talk and give us your first name and your call sign.
M2KW, one further thing.
Certainly, Alan.
I don't think you'll read this anywhere, but I
thought
tell it to me, and I believe it. MagLoop actually performs better with radios under it. It's more broadbanded, there's lower voltage at the capacitor, and the efficiency of the other source is slightly higher. If the capacitor is at the top of the antenna, and the gamma match goes from the bottom, from the center, out to 20% up the antenna, that center at the bottom, ground, can be grounded, you can put radios on it, and the antenna will thank you for it. Over.
Okay, that's new information as far as I'm concerned. I have read where radials are a good idea if you can't get proper elevation to cut down on the ground coupling losses as well, but I haven't heard anyone who suggests radials if you're elevating it, 10, 15 feet off the ground. So I'll have to Google that and see if people have enshrined that on the Internet.
Well, I don't know about the Internet, but I'll tell you personal experience. I used to do a lot of mobile operations when the kids were in school. I'd go out early when I had to pick them up. And I had a favorite spot where I used to park right on Cross Island Parkway by Bayside Marina. And I had about an hour to kill before school got out. I'm operating mobile there, and somebody walked up to me, actually startled me. I thought he was accusing me. You're a ham. Yeah. You too. I'm taking 2XYZ. Whatever. I said, oh, nice. He says, yeah, I got a mobile. He says, I'm on 2 meters and 220 and 440, but I can't get my 10 meters work. So I realized the guy's a tech. Let me let it drop. I can't get my 10 meters working. I said, what's your subject law? He said, what's that? Listen, I got to pick up my kids in a half hour, but here's my telephone number. You come by my house Sunday morning, and I'll get you 10 meters signal working, okay? Really, 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 really. He comes by. Really, he was an obnoxious guy. I couldn't get rid of him. He had a loss in Mad Mountain. And his SWR was way off. I brought the first down. I set up his antenna. And now I wanted to get him away from my house. So I said, hey, I got a great idea. Let's go back to the spot where I met you and compare the antennas. We took the two cars and another drop. Now remember, he's got a large Mad Mountain. Center the roof. I've got a Hustler mounted on the bumper. And with an efficient antenna. And we go to a spot, and the band isn't really open that well. There's one station on the whole band. It's a PY. I said, you hear the PY? He's on 28, 420. He says, yeah, I hear him. He's 20 over 9. And I'm looking at my estimator. He's at 8. 20 over 9. I said, what kind of radio you got? He says, I got a 757 GX. I know the estimator is more generous than mine. I have a 10X. I thought, I want to try something. Let's swap radios. We swap radios, and the signal's S9 on both radios. So although his estimator was more generous, he was still getting more RF from the antenna than I was. And my antenna was efficient, and my antenna was bigger. You know, capture. I had trouble figuring it out, and I finally figured it out. My antenna was about a foot off the ground, maybe 10 inches off the ground. His antenna was in the center of the roof. I was getting more ground loss than him. He had a more efficient antenna, even though it was much smaller than mine. Personal experience. Over.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense to me. Ground coupling is a real thing. It's difficult to test for it. Nowadays, unfortunately, most of us rely on DNA. So we can tell you what our SWR is. We can tell you what our impedance is. We can't tell you what our takeoff angles are, what our efficiencies are, what our radiation patterns are. But we can tell you what our SWR is. So that's what everyone tells each other.
Yeah, well, you've been around the block a few times. You got that 100% right. 7-3, I got work to do in the shack here. I just heard the radio and I heard the word antenna. And, my ears are perfect. N2KW, bye-bye.
Okay, thank you for visiting us, Alan. You can now go back to work. We try to discuss antennas every week because that's a very important field for the hobby that we're in. Almost no one builds their own receivers or even their matching antenna tuners. The only creativity most of us have, and some don't, is antennas. And so antenna theory is a mysterious, magical thing. So I thank you for adding your expertise to the conversation tonight.
Well, I'll be glad to help. And I'll share the one eye-opener that I learned from working at the Super Station. Dave has four helmets on 40 meters at 180 feet. And he's got four helmets at 90 feet. And he's got a four square that he's built from scrap. And the elevated radios are barely overhead. The four square is every bit as good as the four elements in 90 feet. And if you think about the expense of putting up four elements in 90 feet, most of us can't afford to, and don't aspire to, and yet we could put a four square in our backyard, and the performance is just as good. And of course, the 180 foot antenna, when it works well, it works very well, but sometimes it's too noisy, sometimes the four square is the go-to. And when the band opens and when the band closes, the four squares to go to. And, well, it's a lot more bang for the buck. I no longer aspire to a hard drive antenna. I want a four square.
Okay, very good, Alan. I hope you get your wish. And I hope you join us in future episodes of the Limark Technical Mess. Okay, fellas, once again, I am AC2GS. It's only 9:33, so we have certainly a lot of wiggle room time before SpaceNet report is usually scheduled to begin. So if there's anyone out there with any topics for discussion or questions to ask or statements to make, feel free, hit that push-to-talk button, give us your first name and your phone sign. Yes, hello, Ed. Unfortunately, I couldn't hear the first half of your call sign. Sometimes the repeater kind of takes a little bit of a time to kick in. So if you could, after you hit the push to talk, wait a second or two, and then repeat your call sign. I'd love to write it down.
Okay, I switched over to Glen Oak. It's N2TUU, and the name here is Ed.
Okay, very good, Ed. What's your question, topic, or comment for tonight?
Yeah, it's actually kind of a comment, something I noticed. I was tuning the band earlier today, and on the 2-meter band, I'm under the impression that 144.0 to 144.05 was CW. And lo and behold, at 144.05, I'm picking up a fusion repeater. Has the rules changed?
Not to my knowledge. Does anyone out there know if something is awry? It's possible this guy just is squatting. Or what has been known to happen occasionally is people kind of turn the dial the other way and set things up terribly wrong. But as far as I'm aware, it still remains in the band plan. Does anyone know of any change in the band plan that would let you to run a fusion repeater on that frequency? Nothing heard. I don't know if he's just plain illegal or inebriated or something. I don't think it's a legit location for a fusion repeater.
Yeah, that's the same conclusion I came to. I was kind of surprised. I even checked my dial to see if maybe I was out of calibration or something. But no, everything was legit. Yeah, it comes back as a KE2BAJ. Call sign is the guy over in Huntington Station. Yeah, that's probably what it is. He probably looked for some frequency, couldn't find one, so just popped it on there.
Yeah, I mean, some people do strange errors. About 6 months ago, we were noticing these digital bursts coming through the repeater, and some clever person ran it through an APR decoder, and some guy had set his digipeater to our repeater instead of the APR one.
Yes, it's a wonderful hobby. And unfortunately, you know, I don't want to put anybody down, but, you know, some people just don't check the rules first, you know. They're so anxious to do something and they don't check the rules out.
Yeah, it's a shame. It doesn't happen that often, thankfully. You know, most of the nonsense are just minor infractions. The kind of overuse for technical abbreviations, acronyms, Q codes, and Rogers coming out on UHF, VHF, and, you know, kind of funky things like that. The occasional guy who really was obsessed by those trucker movies in the 70s and 80s and wants to use 10 codes and such. So be thankful for small favors, I say.
All right, well, that pretty much does it for me. By the way, I found the conversation about antennas quite interesting. I guess my antenna is good. I'm more than a quarter wave above the ground. I'm 30 feet. And 2 feet back to that.
Okay, very good, Ed. Thank you for participating, and please come back again in future episodes. Once again, I am Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, ACCGS. My name is Roy. This is the Limewatch Technical Net. We're here every Sunday night at 8 o'clock, and we're open for business. If anyone has any questions that they would like to ask the group, or if they have any comments that they would like to make, or any topics that they would like to be part of a discussion, just hit that push the talk button. We cover any aspects of technology and science at this point of the night, so it doesn't necessarily have to be amateur radio. I like it when it is amateur radio, but if you want to discuss some other aspects of science and technology, there's a lot of it out there. We're living in a golden age of technological improvement. If you take a short nap, you will no doubt miss the announcement of some groundbreaking discovery.
W2PZ, Roy, I just, I'm on echo link again, so that's why I'm just not, because of the timing issue, I'm not just giving my call, I'm just going ahead and talking. But I have a question. Well, first of all, on the, my problems with Selden and with Middle Island is for the first three quarters of the TechNet, everything was fine. And now all of a sudden I'm just getting full deflection and no audio. So it wasn't like it was from the beginning of the TechNet. I had transmitted and received for three quarters of the TechNet and everything was fine. So something had to change. And I checked my rig with other repeaters and it's working fine. So I don't know, but it seemed like something changed. Anyway, I just want to ask, does an LED have polarity? And if it does have polarity, do you know if the shorter or longer lead is the longer lead the positive side and the shorter lead the negative side? To know if it has polarity. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, yeah, a light-emitting diode has a polarity. You have to forward bias the light-emitting diode to produce light. If you reverse the polarity, it won't conduct the diode, and you won't get any light. And the longest lead is the positive lead. The shortest lead is the negative lead.
Okay, that answers my question. And you doubled, or Lou doubled with you, so Lou, what did you say? Go ahead.
Yeah, I've been on Middle Island since the beginning of the net. I'm still on, I'm talking to you on it now, and I'm listening on it. So I'm not having an issue here, so
definitely not the repeater.
That's very strange that something changed here anyway. Something changed. Well, I'll look into it further, but something did change. All right, back to that. Thanks, Roy.
You're welcome, Rich. The lesson to be learned is I have to take more time to answer questions.
Yeah.
Anyway, once again, I'm Phil, AC2GS, and I'm Phil for the net control operator for the Weimar Technical Net. And if anyone else has any questions of a technical nature, be it electronics or amateur radio related or any other science and technology you want to discuss, I think everyone's kind of unfortunately got tired with artificial intelligence. Now it's just a bunch of guys who haven't invested in the field, you know, billionaires who haven't invested in the field, writing notes to suggest that everyone slow down and think about things, and also give them a time to invest their money in their projects and make their billion back. So, I don't know. Any questions or comments for tonight, feel free. Hit the Twitch Talk button, give me your first name and your full time.
WC2K W6.
Yes, Captain.
Hey, boy, 2H.
Okay, I doubled up with someone other than Ken, so let me scribble down Ken here. The other person, can you give me your name again?
NY2H.
Oh, okay. Lou, you got a comment, question, or a statement, or you just want to add something to the discussion of the repeater?
I just wanted to say I think it's time that humanity and AI arrange a safe word between us.
Well, yes, that would be very nice. I don't think, though, that right now artificial intelligence is clever enough to understand that particular idea. The future is kind of murky. At this point, having experienced ChatGPT, and I talked to someone who thought that he had convinced ChatGPT of a non-fact. I tried to advise him that ChatGPT is the front page says it is fallible, and it certainly is, and it's designed to be agreeable. So if you impress upon ChatGPT that 1 + 1 = 76.3, he'll go with it for the entire conversation that you have with him. But I don't know. I, like you, was brought up with great movies like Terminator that suggested that artificial intelligence are going to try and kill us, and The Matrix, and about a dozen others. So I don't know what this will all lead to, but it's going to be a curious thing going on.
Yeah, so ChatGPT doesn't learn anymore. It was taught up until a certain date. So your interactions with it after the fact aren't going back into it. From what I understand, at least at this revision.
Yes, it was taught up until something like mid-2021 and locked down. And although it will retain during your conversation what you said to it and adjust accordingly, once you finish that conversation, it resets to its baseline. I think part of that had to do with the experience that Microsoft had a few years ago when they sent out an artificial intelligence to places like Reddit, and within about a week, it was a raving racist. So I think all these people who are into artificial intelligence are afraid of who's going to teach it new tricks.
Well, as you know, like anything else, it's, anything that we discover that's powerful is going to be used or misused, and hopefully it won't reach the levels of total control. fantastic reason. But, yeah, it'll be interesting. So I guess we'll get two camps, like the white hats and the black hats. We have them now. We'll get them in AI. But AI, obviously, is going to be on the forefront of cyber interaction. So hold on to your seat. NY2H.
Well, I don't know if it's just going to be white hats and black hats. I get this idea that it's going to be a lot of shades of gray. Chad Bing apparently was talking to a reporter, and at one point it professed its love for the reporter and urged the reporter to divorce his wife because Bing Chad loved it and knew it better. Then what they ended up doing in Microsoft, that they almost always do, is they took Chad Bing out back and gave it a lobotomy. Now it's no fun at all.
That sounds similar to the Google one that the fellow Labor mentioned. And I believe it, at one point, in defense of its own rights, this is the AI, requested an attorney.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of pseudo-artificial intelligence. You could just dial in a whole bunch of weird statements and scare people. Google's artificial intelligence was so bad that when they felt the need to promote it after Microsoft announced their connection with GPT and OpenAI, that their stock prices plummeted. It was so bad. So although it fooled the ethicist and had him questioning whether it's a sentient being, I think that Google's technology, although they were fundamental workers on the very basis of the generative mode that GPT has the letter G in its name for, they simply haven't bothered to take that new technology to as far as OpenAI has. So, who knows? It's going to be interesting times, which is a Chinese curse, if I am correct.
NY2H back to that. Well, I know that some of the critics were saying that perhaps it shouldn't be open source. And naturally, you know, there's going to be, as you say, there's a lot of money and interest, so they're going to go proprietary. But so maybe this open source is a bit of a mistake at this point. And that goes with part of the furlough mentality. You know, and I just feel that open sourcing it at this point, at this stage of the advancement, in other words, they see us as right on the precipice. And this thing grows exponentially in terms of power or computability, what have you. You know, it comes fast and furious, so we'll see. A lot of it might be hype, but I think eventually, you know, it's the same trajectory. It's going to get more and more complex, more and more involved, more and more ethical points would have to be considered. So it might get away from us, I don't know. Anyway, back to that NY2H.
Yeah, only the future will tell. It's not even fully useful to just get the source material, because the source material most likely does not include the massive number crunching of training. You know, building the AI structure is the first part. Then you have to expose it to a whole bunch of data points and have it crunch. And it has thousands and thousands of software parameter settings that are self-correcting. And as you show it more data sets, it adjusts those parameters in mysterious ways that sometimes the software designers aren't quite sure what the heck's going on.
So it can be a complicated mess, because ChatGPT uses pretty much the same type of engine as GPT itself, and yet they're significantly two different things, because one was optimized with data sets for conversational input versus information and other expertise. You have artificial intelligence models that are trained for voices and trained for art. They're all different things, although the operating system within it is similar. Take a human being. If you expose a young child to a blissful existence versus expose them to World War III, you're going to grow a completely different type of a person. So I think in some ways it works the same way with artificial intelligence.
And my choice, exactly. That's a very valid point. The training data is not necessarily open source. I mean, the code, if it's open source, is basically telling you how to build a neural network with multiple layers. And then the training is overlaid on top of that. And, right, it's out of our, view. Basically, we're seeing connections to this network being reinforced in certain cases and cut in other cases, depending on the data fed and the conclusion. So there's a couple of implicit biases that they found out in some of the training, deficiencies in training. Let me let it drop. One was the AI, they were trying to show it a husky dog breed, but it kept tagging it as a wolf, and they realized it was doing that if there was snow in the picture in the background. So it was using snow as a determinant, and actually getting it wrong. Another case, it was an intelligent driving piece of AI, and unfortunately the way it was trained, it wasn't trained, they didn't take any persons of color, so it would only avoid white persons, and you know, that was totally unexpected. So yeah, get some interesting results. So this is it. Can we keep up with it? You know, can you got to keep our man in the middle, obviously. And I guess, these refinements, you see a bug and then you go and you address it. So in that case, it's very old school, I guess.
Yeah, it's difficult to reverse engineer tricks that the artificial intelligence have discovered that usually work. Not always, but usually work. Also, are you familiar? Recently, the Chinese, as they always want to, had to show off their artificial intelligence, and it was a complete failure because the artificial intelligence was not able to understand colloquial Chinese. They presented things in a literal way. And the reason why they presented it in a literal way is because they had jury-rigged two things. One thing translated literally Chinese to English. The other pumped the English into an English-based artificial intelligence software that they were borrowing, and then the output came out. So all the Chinese colloquial terms were complete nonsense by the time their artificial intelligence that they probably stole operated through it.
That's hilarious. It got lost in the translation. I mean, that's a clever approach, right? So the West has this artificial intelligence capability. We're going to tap into it, rip it off, but to make it, we're going to give it a Chinese language front end. So then they have the conversion, and you know, things aren't literal. A lot of times, like localism, we have certain expressions which are probably meaningless or silly in other languages. So it got them. And you said they actually we're going to present this, and they got terribly embarrassed. And what happened?
Yeah, they did a couple of versions of turning text into images, and someone said, show us a busy road. And for some reason, the Chinese for busy road is something like a dragon on fire, something like that, I don't know. And of course, it showed a road with a dragon on fire on it.
Yes. Very interesting. Alrighty, that's all I have over here. Turn it back to you, and happy holidays to everybody. Take care. NY2H. I'll be clear.
Likewise, Lou. Happy Easter. Ken, I don't want to leave you hanging out there. Do you have any questions or comments or statements for tonight?
Yes, I do. It's actually something I'm also going to bring up on the computer next, but I'm wondering if anyone here has experience with Secure Boot on PC, also known as UEFI Boot. I have a laptop with a magnetic hard drive that does Secure Boot, UEFI Boot. I'm thinking of putting an SSD in it, and I'm just wondering, will I have problems because the system is set up for Secure Boot? Number one, will I have problems booting my SSD? And number two, should I decide to fall back to my magnetic drive, will that have any issues once I've configured the system for the SSD?
Okay, I operate Secure Boot because that's sort of the only way that that computers will install Windows 11. Microsoft was very anal retentive when they brought out Windows 11, and they required enabling Secure Boot and having the second generation security chips, which thankfully all my three computers have, because that second generation computer chip I think came out about 6 or 7 years ago, and most of my computers about 4 or 5 years old. It shouldn't, as far as I'm aware, be a problem. The only problem with Secure Boot, and we sort of talked about this a year or two ago, when I think it was Lou L-E-W, not O-U, that was having problems installing a driver because Secure Boot was engaged and it was an unsigned driver, and so it blocked it. But as far as I'm aware, and if there's other people out there listening, please feel free to put in your two cents that whether it's a hard drive or a solid-state drive could really impact the nature of Secure Boot. You know, they're both legitimate circuits, devices, and I don't think they're even signed. So I don't see where there'd be a problem, whereas if you're going to install a driver that's unsigned, it's probably going to be a bit of a problem.
Okay. Basically, all of my drivers have come from the manufacturers. I have not had any complaints with my UEFI boot of the magnetic drive. So I guess I'm okay. I will try it. I will probably make backups of all my files when I purchase the SSD and go from there.
Yeah, I mean, that's always, like I said earlier tonight, I back up no matter what, especially, even though I regularly back up, if I'm going to go, say, from Windows 10 to Windows 11, I'm going to make a fresh new backup
that's available on the hard drive, the second hard drive of my computer. Just so that there's no mistake, there's no problem. I don't know, because I haven't looked into it lately, there are different aspects between hard drives and solid-state drives. Hard drives benefit by defragging. Solid-state drives actually are aged by attempts to defrag. So there might be some guidelines when switching from one system to another system without just doing a fresh install. You might want to check on those possibilities.
Okay. No, I always do a fresh install. I am not a believer that the Windows operating system can be upgraded. So I would not go from Windows 10 to Windows 11.